Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 281, which, Kristen, is a prime number, believe it or not.
Oh.
And that is completely by accident. But it is relevant to our guest, who is Andy Lomas, who is an artist and lecturer and in creative computing. Andy is a fascinating person and a true math geek like myself, right, Kristen?
Oh yeah, you guys are math and filmmaking. I said, is your jam?
That's yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. He's a pretty cool guy. He's actually in the UK. Again, this is pretty interesting and cool that now we're opening up the podcast to a lot more remote locations by obligation, but also cool that we can do it with Andy. While he's in the UK and still had a really, really great podcast together. And the video worked out pretty well, too. So, you know, he was showing me all of his amazing artwork that he's done, which is really great. What are some of the cool takeaways that you got from this podcast?
Well, I thought it was interesting. So after he graduated from Cambridge, he went on to visual effects and got to work on some of the Matrix movies, which was awesome. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the lead developers of Katana.
That's true. And he worked at the Foundry as well and was developing the Foundry, Katana at the Foundry. He's no longer at the Foundry. He's sort of become an independent CG artist, right? And what's mm-hmm. What do you think about that stuff?
So he has like the cool CG artwork that he does, and he makes it through deep learning and then NVIDIA's Optic X API. So he creates like plant-like and cellular forms. So I was like, oh, it's so confusing. But he brings together influences from like nature, physics, and biology. So really, really interesting, really cool. And then also in the podcast posts, we'll have the talk about his paper that Understanding Aesthetic Evaluation, Learning Deep Learning that him and John McCormack wrote. And then there's also a video that's linked.
Yeah,
to that.
It's a really cool podcast. Research paper that he did, because it's about using deep learning to evaluate aesthetic decision making. And it's basically saying teaching a computer how to like things or not like things or what you like. Because if you have to go through thousands and thousands and thousands of images and say, I like this, I don't like this, which is kind of one of the things we get into, the computer will help you get filter through that stuff pretty easily through deep learning. It's actually fascinating talk and a really great talk, a really great paper. And we go through it extensively with Andy. And I think it's important because, honestly speaking, you know, there's so many things that are on the internet that our people, you know, our customers make, and just the idea of having something that is figuring out what is attractive in a weird way, or what makes an interesting image is an interesting paper to write as well. We have a ton of announcements, right?
Yeah, we do. All right. So you can find all these out at chaosgroup.com. So the big one is we announced last week, V-Ray 5 for 3DS Max is now available. So you can get that. And then update, another one is Phoenix FD 4 update 2 is now available. And it's compatible with 3DS Max 2021 and V-Ray 5.
Yeah, and very important that you guys get that. If you guys are using Phoenix FD, you will need that update in order to take advantage of V-Ray 5. I learned it the hard way myself. So you need to get, basically make sure you get that update, because then all of your V-Ray 5 stuff will be nicely accelerated and it'll be very compatible with Phoenix. So make sure you get that as well. And then a couple other ones as well.
Yes, V-Ray for Unreal update 3. And then we have the V-Ray 5 for Maya Beta is now available. Yep. And then the last is our V-Ray collection, which we announced last week as well.
Yeah, V-Ray collections is a big deal. Basically, we're offering a collection where you get you can buy basically all the licenses of V-Ray for all the different platforms. And then V-Ray Phoenix FD as well. You'll also get all of those. And then you'll get Project Lavina. You'll get some cloud credits. You'll also get V-Ray scans, all in one collection. So it's basically like our universal license that contains everything, which is pretty great. Definitely worth checking out if you guys are big V-Ray users and want to use it across different platforms. This is a really good solution for all of you guys, as well as getting access to Phoenix and all the other stuff. So really, really cool. Okay, cool. And let's just, you know, if people want to know more about this podcast, where can they go?
You can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
And of course, we will always take more suggestions on some cool guests that we would like to have. As you guys know, we are reaching out a much wider net across the entire globe now, not just places where I am or going to be, since I'm just stuck at home and like everyone else. So definitely let us know. We'd love to get your suggestions. labs@chaosgroup.com is where you can email us and just let us know what your thoughts are. I would also say that, reminder that these are video podcasts now as well. The video podcast is up on our Facebook page, as we mentioned before. That's facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast. But it's also available on our YouTube channel for Chaos Group. So just go to look up Chaos Group TV on our YouTube channel, and all of our podcasts are in video form there. For this particular podcast, believe it or not, it's actually important because Andy was in his office, and he had all these 3D prints of some of the sculptures he'd been doing that he was showing me. So if you guys want to see what he's talking about, you guys need to check out the video form as well. All right, guys, hopefully you'll enjoy this amazing podcast with Mr. Andy Lomas.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So, Andy, I am drinking out of a mug that is, let's see if you can see it.
Yeah, that's
close
better,
to
yeah.
30 years old. It's the old Mathematica mug.
That's that good knot on there by looks of it. Good genuine knot.
Yeah. So I was a math major in undergraduate, and my math professor gave me this mug as as something that I was going to be for my graduation, because my first foray into computer graphics was actually trying to figure out multi-dimensional space on a Next machine using Mathematica.
Okay, all right. Makes sense.
That's what got me into computer graphics, believe it or not, was actually mathematical objects. So I think this is very inspirational to me. So I would love to know your background and how did your math and art come together as well at some point?
Oh, it's a long and twisted road.
Really?
I guess I do come from a math background originally. That I guess my undergraduate years were spent doing maths. Basically, I studied maths at Cambridge back in the 80s. So you can see quite a lot of grey hairs probably there. That was quite a long time ago. And I guess when I was there, I got quite into what's called dynamical systems, which is, I guess, the whole maths of things that feed back into themselves, things that get iterated, basically the non-linear, interesting function things. So it's basically the branch of maths that things like chaos theory and things like that are almost like a subset.
And fractals and all that stuff.
Yeah, so it's about the dynamical nature of things, where you sort of take the result and you feed it back into yourself again and again and again and again, where you often get these crazily complex sort of things happening. And so I guess that was sort of the area of maths that I was most interested in. And I guess
was it the visuals that interested you about it?
I think more just this idea of the astounding richness that you can get from such simple functions. I mean, the Mandelbrot set is sort of a classic one where it's almost like the simplest nonlinear function you can always come up with, almost just like take a value and just keep on squaring it and adding it to itself and squaring it and adding it to itself, squaring it and adding it to itself. So it's almost like, as something that's nonlinear, it's about as simple as it could be, and yet it makes the Mandelbrot set. You know, it's sort of and I guess that was that. I was always interested in the idea of almost like, you know, could maths be used in biology and things like that? And I just read this book by a Scottish zoologist and philosopher and mathematician called Darcy Wentworth Thompson, if you're visualizing like this old guy with a great big long beard and things like that, you've got it absolutely sort of dead on. So it's basically this sort of Scottish guy who wrote a book over 100 years ago called On Growth and Form, which I guess back then was the crazy idea that maths was actually relevant to biology. It was about the maths behind and the physics behind things like shells growing and structures that are built, where it was like you take this form that's grown so far and then you grow more and then you grow more and then you grow more.
Yeah.
But it still has to follow the rules of physics. Hell has to follow. You know, it can't just be assembled by, you know, like the way buildings are built. It has to be, you know, always viable, you know, as it's
right
during its process of growth, which then constrains what it can do, but also results in maybe the amazing structures we see in things like, you know, plants and seashells and things like that. So I guess I was studying dynamical systems and then reading this dangerous book from over 100 years ago, and it sort of sort of the two went together. I guess I was also interested in, like, you know, imagery and film photography. I mean, I was, as far as my tutor's concerned, I probably wasted far too much time. I was very much involved in that university filmmaking society. So I spent, you know, far much too much time. I probably should have been studying more maths, you know, going out with video cameras and, you know, filming things and then getting time in editing suites and putting together, like, you know, videos of friends in bands for almost like pop promo videos and things like that. So
but that's fun though.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
The fact that you had to exercise both sides of your brain in some ways.
And you sort of then they can combine together. Yeah. So it's sort of,
I did it. I was very blunt about it in school. Mm-hmm. I was a double major in math and art. So I told them, I was like, I'm doing both.
Okay. Right, yeah.
And so my math became more creative and my art became more rigorous.
Unfortunately, they didn't, and I'm sure they probably still don't offer programs like that at Cambridge.
It's
the UK's education system tends to be much more like, here's the narrow channel that you will go down. But I guess I've now found the enclave where you can combine the two. And I'm now actually lecturing part time at a university called Goldsmiths in London, which is a pretty weird university because it was like originally an art college, and then it became a full university, and now has a full computer science department, which actually does quite a lot of research into, you know, artificial intelligence and machine learning, things like that. Mm-hmm. But also has a huge art side to it. So it actually, you know, has programs in computational art, and which is what I'm mostly involved in. So I maybe found the enclave where you can put together, you know, maths and computing and art, and it's not only accepted, they even pay you for it.
Good for you. We'll get to that. We'll get to that because I think we're skipping a few parts of your history. Where do we get there? But yeah, you're right.
Story.
Absolutely. So you're at Cambridge and you're doing, you're making films and doing math at the same time.
And reading books by crazy Scotsmen. I guess I also read books, papers by, like, crazy English people Alan Turing. And we, again, that idea of incredibly simple functions or incredibly simple machines, but, you know, can make astonishingly complicated things, which is, I guess, that's a common theme.
Yeah.
So I guess as I left college, and I guess I did the obvious thing with a degree in maths, which I joined with another friend who also had the degree in maths. And we met someone else who had a degree in film and video and theatre, and we set up a small video production company. So I did that for about 3 years, genuine, you know, video cameras and hiring out TV studios and stuff like that and things, and making training videos for Ford Motor Company and things like that.
And then I
finally put two and two together of, actually, we got given a computer. This goes back in the 1980s, where, you know, just having a decent computer at all was pretty remarkable. They were actually given a computer by winning this, like, the regional finals, this young people in business competition, and one of the prizes was, here's a computer. You had to write, what would you use a computer for in your company? And we wrote about what we would use a computer for. We got one which actually could do quite a lot of graphics, I think, called the Acorn, the Archimedes. And then I finally just almost like put two and two together of, like, ooh, computer graphics. That's a way of combining this stuff.
Right.
Then did a master's in computer graphics animation, and then sort of got into the crazy world, which I think you know about very well, the film and video industry.
So you did a lot of work, obviously. You've done a lot of work in the visual effects world as well. I mean, some of the stuff you were doing. You're one of the main people responsible for Katana, as far as I know as well, right?
Well, I guess it's Steve Levites and the guys at Sony. Give them full credit that they were the real founding fathers of Katana. But I guess I was hearing about Katana. I worked at a company called ESC in California, in the Bay Area.
In the Bay Area, working on the Matrix, I'm sure.
Well, Matrix 2 and 3, and then we worked on some other films after that as well. But it's this sort of Skunk Works, crazy computer graphics and visual effects company, which was basically half owned by the Wachowskis, half owned by the Warner Brothers, set up to do Matrix 2 and 3. And I guess I was involved in quite a lot of crazy, almost like doing things on the rendering side, almost like, how can we pull together all our assets and do the, I wrote these crazy sort of called geometry shader things, which a lot of our pipeline for some of our more complex shots became based around these crazy geometry shader things that I'd written for pulling together assets and then processing and overriding and modifying things before actually whilst they were getting rendered. And I had some friends at Sony who were sort of pinging me for a while going, we got this crazy thing here called Katana. It's a bit like this thing called some of the crazy ideas we had at the ESC. And then I heard that Sony had sold the commercial rights to Katana to the Foundry. So I think I accidentally talked myself into a job at their Christmas party where I was going, you've got Katana. What are you going to do with Katana? Katana's really interesting. What are you going to do with Katana?
And right.
Andy, how about you join us and do some things with Katana? So I joined the Foundry to do things with Katana.
That's really cool. That's really cool. Yeah, I mean, I was the last person, the last show at Sony that was using burps at the time, and it was, boy, was it archaic.
I've heard about that.
Katana definitely seemed like a way better option than burps at the time, and I envied those who were using it. But it's a really cool program. Obviously, it's what's also interesting. I mean, actually, I did a podcast recently with Jodie Madden, actually, believe it or not. And so I was talking about Katana, and I said, what's really interesting about it is that it's being used in ways that I didn't expect, but it totally makes sense. For example, the automotive industry loves it because you can put enormous amount of different states of cars together as a system in Katana. So that's really pretty cool little idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're at the Foundry and you're working at the Foundry for a while, but then I think somehow you started to get really interested in art and doing that kind of stuff, right?
Well, I guess that goes back way back. I mean, I was always sort of interested in doing my own little things. So even back in I joined Framestore in London back in about 93, I think, as I remember. But I was still doing my own little crazy things on the side, use the Silicon Graphics computers for doing, genetically programmed things, doing crazy stuff and things. And then also when I was at ESC, I got time, particularly after actually finishing work on Matrix 3, where we had this huge render farm, and I sort of managed to persuade them not to quite switch off all the machines they were planning to, because we were carrying on working on other films, but we didn't need quite as big a render farm. So I got an allocation to carry on doing some of my crazy experiments and things like that. I was doing things alongside, and then worked at DreamWorks for a bit, and actually my first stuff shown at the Sigroff and the Art Gallery was actually whilst I was working at DreamWorks and things. So I was sort of doing stuff alongside, and partly it was almost like a running joke for many years with me and some friends, where it's almost like doing all the things you're not allowed to do in production, so it's always, which is quite a nice sort of way of sort of focusing and making it fun. It's sort of like, doing stuff that's deliberately out of control, doing stuff where if I got a note from a review session saying, that's great, but could you change this and this and this? I would just go, no, I've got no idea how to change that to make it do what you're asking to do it. I mean, it's almost like that's the whole point. It's sort of got to be meant to be ridiculously intricate, complex, but rich and genuinely surprising me. And maybe I can sort of understand why it's done something when I see the result, but I've got no idea how to control it to make it do, know, exactly what I want. You know, which obviously is the whole game almost always in professional visual effects. Being professional generally is doing rich, complex, amazing, but totally under control. Totally, right. You know, any note that comes from the VFX supervisor, the art director, the director saying, keep everything the same, but change that one thing. You know exactly how to do it. So you've over-engineered everything to a ludicrous degree so that you can change anything they may ask for in any way. You know, that's what you're hoping for.
That's why we are direct skies in visual effects, exactly. Which you can do in real life.
Anything. Yeah, exactly. Because you can. And because you know they're going to ask you to do that. And if, if you've done something and then they ask you to do something and you go, no. then no one's going to be pleased with you,
right?
So it's almost my own work was the utter opposite. It was this is me with my computer, just deliberately using it almost as a canvas for the unexpected, but right. Rich, organic. You know, I don't want just random. I want stuff which has unexpected rich structure. I guess is one of my big things. Which I guess is the sort of thing that, nature has in, spades. You know, it's sort of like, how do we end up with the... And also I think we're psychologically attuned to the things in nature. So there's something human about looking at certain types of organic, crazy complexity, which have an effect on us. You know, like, watching clouds. Yeah, like going out into a forest and, how rich the fields, or wind blowing through a field, and all those sorts of things, where things that make
growth
us go
ferns, well, growth of ferns and how their leaves look and all that stuff, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you have filling this this environment, and you go, what are the places where you want to hang out?
Right. Yeah.
So, and can we make use of almost the same sort of ingredients in a computer?
Mm-hmm.
And often it has this, almost like difficult relationship with control. That, the more you want those things to basically be more like process and rule based, the more difficult it can be to control those. And I guess I've gone a bit sort of full circle. That I sort of like a. I'm now actually one of the almost like even more interesting point maybe for me now is almost like says the joke. The let's do something that's totally out of control. Let's do the stuff. If James Cameron was directing this film and this was an element in it, we would be so screwed because he would ask for it to be modified in that one way. And we got no idea how to do it. So
that's why I always feel sorry for Houdini artists, because they deal so much with chaos in what they do. And then they're always asked to change one particle it's a simulation.
You end up not re-rendering. You end up going a nuke and just cutting that particle out and putting it over there.
Yeah, just
don't change anything else.
I know.
You fake it,
I know. It's just very... I know exactly what you mean. Like I said, I am very sympathetic towards it, but at the same time, I completely understand your idea of beauty and simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing math and art at the same time, and I would sort of integrate some of my math and my art, and bring some of my art into my math. Believe it or not, I figured out how to do that. I used to just make my professors giggle about it. But
professors would just say, "You're wasting your time."
It's having fun, right? But I think my professors, especially my math professors, really appreciated the fact that I saw beauty in math, and so they liked that part of it, right?
Yeah.
And so I was doing some topology stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I was obsessed with Klein bottles because, they're beautiful and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to recreate a Klein bottle, but in four dimensions so that it wouldn't cross itself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because you can't make a proper Klein bottle in 3D. Yeah.
You can't make it improperly in 3D. So I made it in 3D. So I basically created a Mathematica equation, which put it in three parts. So it was the head part, and then the other part, and then the loop part. And so it was a long equation in Mathematica to make that happen, but I tried to get it so that, it would go through W space so that it wouldn't cross itself.
Yeah, maybe just
and it was clunky.
Just a little bridge into W,
And it was a clunky equation, and it looked okay. It looked like the traditional Klein bottle we know, but it looked okay. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, this can't be right. And so I then decided I was going to make another equation, which was basically just a torus that flips itself inside out, right? Because that's basically what a Klein bottle is. And so I have a torus, and it has a pinch into itself to flip itself, basically the combination of a Mobius strip and a torus. And then I used my program in Mathematica that I had developed over the summer, which was a four-dimensional perspective system, which allowed me to basically create 3D shadows of the four-dimensional space. And I moved around my pinched torus. And as I did that, it slowly deformed and turned into a representation of the torus that I wanted. As I was moving through 4D space. And I was like, oh my God, I got the torus. I got the Klein bottle. And so I made this painting of the two equations, one the very complicated one, and the other one, it was just like four lines. And I showed the representation of the Klein bottles, and I was like, look at that. And my art students, fellow students, did not like my art at all. They did not see the beauty that I saw in the equation.
Absolutely.
But so, I know what you mean. Sometimes it's so exciting to see such simple things turn into such beautiful things at the same time, you know? So I can totally get what you mean by that. But you've done your art that I've seen, and I've seen a lot of it, is very generative. It's a lot about the generative process, right?
Yeah.
And cellular structures and biology. So how did you combine all of that kind of stuff together? What were some of your inspiration, and how did you sort of figure out what to do?
I guess I'd almost always sort of reinvent the wheel. They say I'm very bad at, I think, lots of people from mass backgrounds. It's like, I don't care what anyone else is doing. Let's just invent all this myself. So I guess, the whole idea of, growth by iteration, picking almost like, growth by, I guess one of my earlier work was more on accumulated growth, which actually there's a quite classic sort of fractal algorithm called diffusion limited aggregation that's almost like accumulating things by randomly, almost like particles, almost like in water, randomly accumulating. And my take on that was what happens if you change the environment? What happens if you sort of influence and bias the system? How much do you need to bias it before it sort of starts suddenly folding into different behavior? And then it was like, that creates a certain, actually often very coral-like sort of structures. Actually from coral-like to almost like bacteria growth in petri dishes and things like that. There's a sort of classic diffusion limited aggregation range of structures you sort of get. Right. And one of the big questions is then, why don't you get things like animal-like structures, I guess, particularly almost like internal organs or folded skin or, those sorts of things. So I guess I'm intrigued way of maybe, a more almost like cellular, instead of almost like just accumulating where the food comes from, is where the growth happens, more idea of having sheets of cells and cells actually, actively growing and modifying. And also, I guess there's a really nice sort of mathematical ideas in sort of hyperbolic planes and sort of the idea of surfaces with, curvatures that may make this shape of the structure really interestingly, richly complex. So the idea, if you've got a growing set of cells, hope you could grow them in ways which maybe would naturally have these sort of curvatures, which also create almost like tensions in the system. So it's your diffusion limiting aggregation. It's very static sort of forms you go. So the idea of, let's have it dynamic. Let's have it, there are tensions in the surface of cells and things could then hopefully, fold and twist and turn in interesting ways. So it's basically just didn't read any proper biology, just wrote code to just say, I've got a concept of a cell, it's linked to other cells around it, it's exerting forces on those cells. I want to actively grow them in ways that hopefully are going to be these sort of like almost like rubber sheets. They're going to naturally want to fold, so it's a bit like cloth simulation stuff, I guess.
There's forces on these. You must put some kind of forces or arbitrary ideas that create sort of restrictions or manipulations in some way, right?
Yes. There's things that introduce dynamics. I guess one of I quite like is playing not only fast and loose with biology, but also physics. I how different could this be from classic biology? What is it going to do? Is it going to be ridiculously alienly, whoa, that just looks so completely different? Or is it going to actually be, you know, everything's, the rules are so different, yet it produces the same stuff or makes it really familiar. So that's the sort of almost art ideas that I'm interested in. So, almost like deliberately not worrying whether the system is an accurate simulation of biology and actually someone's reveling where, you know, same with physics stuff. So one thing I'm doing is sort of to make things a bit more stable is not doing things as straight force equations, as I'm doing what's usually called that throwing the momentum term away, which is something that potentially makes the system more stable. But it's, though in some ways it's a bit like something being, you know, like a very small thing underwater. You know, it's sort of like, you know, instead, I mean, it's a sort of, it's a traditional approach sometimes done in like cloth simulations to make the system more stable. And it's just like, fine, makes it more stable, makes the code easy, makes the simulation work. Great. Totally throw away the momentum term everywhere. So there's things like that where I'm, you know, it's almost like anything to make it so that, I guess one of my big things is wanting to get to ridiculous levels of complexity, you know, millions, many millions and things like that of units. It's something I'm always trying to get to. And I guess it's something I learned, you know, you're doing visual effects on films is, you know, your techniques. How do you push the systems to be able to at least do several millions of things?
Right.
But in part of, in order to get to that point, you generally have to, you know, throw anything away that's going to be complicated to calculate because, you know, otherwise you're going to get to thousands, you're not going to get to millions. So, you know, you you learn the professional craft of throwing everything away that you don't need.
You'd rather do a million small calculations than a thousand more complicated ones, right?
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. It's also been interesting that, I mean, I've met quite a few people doing almost like similar-ish sort of things, but in proper science, proper, almost like trying to do like, you know, proper cellular. I've got quite a few been in life sciences institutes and things like that, you know, where they're doing as accurate as possible cell growth systems. And it's, and what's quite fun is, you know, comparing, you know, it's sort of what's same and what's different. And like there was a guy up at the Life Sciences Institute at the University of Dundee that I sort of talked to quite a lot recently. And he's a physicist who's on secondment to this Life Sciences Institute. And very much what he's trying to do is like as accurate as possible simulations, which means that he can generally only do a few thousand things. You know, and is often trying to look for was like the typical behavior. Whereas what I'm often looking for is saying, unless I can do millions, it's not, there's something I think about an aesthetic response we have to things that are structured, but a sufficient level of complexity. Which I, and a threshold, I mean, a rule of thumb I always had when I was working in the industry was you've got to be able to always get to the level of millions before you get to an interesting level of complexity. It does, you know, it goes from looking just like, was like chemical models of a protein to looking like something rich.
That's nice.
Now,
have you obviously, is your work taking advantage of GPUs at this point? Because GPUs can do millions of things now. little things.
Or you badly code a GPU and it goes even slower than a normal CPU.
Yes, it's true. It's true.
I'm all my cell growth systems. Actually, I originally coded it all to run on the CPU, basically, I wanted to get this almost like electrostatic repulsion between cells, sort of to just like soft collision things, so that things that they fold over, they sort of push each other apart a bit. And yeah, that's the point where my code just became way too slow. And I had a friend who was actually working at NVIDIA who kept on prodding me, going, Andy, put it on the GPU. It on the GPU.
Eventually, it seems like it was ripe for that.
Absolutely. He was right. And he managed to get me a GPU. So I was like, Andy, there's a GPU. Put it on the GPU.
And yeah, that's amazing.
And it did work. And it, you know, so it's, I'm quite a fan of the massively parallel processing. The idea of having, you know, that, you know, and there's the rules of thumb with GPU programming, unless you have at least, you know, 10,000 threads, you're wasting your time. You know, you've got to, so you've just gone from like, you know, CPU programming where a few tens of threads is like, whoa, that's difficult, to GPU programming where I guess actually that they, you're so restricted what you can do, it's actually a lot easier. than general CPU programming, because there's almost everything you can do, could do that makes it complicated, you're not allowed to do on the GPU. But you've got to write your code to at least be doing, like, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of, or tens of millions or hundreds of millions. You can set off 100 million threads and it's just fine. You know, it's just, that's what it's designed to do.
Yep.
Which is, hey, a thread per cell. I've got 100 million cells. Great. It can do it.
Wow. There you go.
As long as your code, it still has to be written to be efficient enough, but the ability to simulate almost like a biological level of complexity, I guess, to my mind, that's what modern, I'm really lucky that I'm alive in a time where these machines, which are, you know, what were huge supercomputers until astonishingly recently, and mainly because of computer games, and now probably as far as now being pushed for ray tracing and stuff like that, as you know, you guys know.
Yep.
You know, the astonishing power that you have in a GPU, and it's like getting so much faster all the time as well, you know. Yeah, so that's like, thank you, computer gamers.
Yes,
I'll take those machines. And I've got a very boring machine down there, which is actually a water cooled, reasonably top end dual GPU, you know, water cooling blocks and everything in the machine. I haven't got all the LED lights and things like that. So I don't care about that. It processes stuff ridiculously fast, you know.
Well, it's kind of amazing. NVIDIA is kind enough to loan me a bunch of computers so that I can test our stuff and a bunch of things. I'm actually recording this podcast right now on a Razer laptop. 15-inch Razer laptop, it has a Quadro RTX 5000 in it, it's under five pounds. This thing could run Flame on it. It's crazy.
We were about 10 years ago, and I joined the foundry, and then, you know, came around with Katana, and that I could, But laptops have got to the point where, you know, I could have a Linux laptop to go around, you know, sit in my backpack, and I could run Katana almost every render at reasonably decent speed. I think I did a demo at the Foundry party at Siggrove, where we had a crowd system, I think, with 50,000 characters with Katana overriding individual, like, you know, hats on different, you know, characters in the crowd and things like that. And actually getting that rendering in a live demo in the middle of the party.
That's pretty amazing. You know? Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's pretty cool. And it, you know, I think it's nice to be able to have that kind of freedom to be able to you know, take that power with you to go, because you're right. It used to be, you have to rent supercomputer time, and that was not cool.
I saw any supercomputers. There is a very nice supercomputer down in the corner.
Right there.
Gamer level tech, which is, you know.
Yep. It's pretty cool. I don't know if you've met Scott Eden. Do you know Scott Eden? Have you heard of him at all?
No, I don't think I do, actually.
You know, you guys are both in London. I'm going to set you guys up on a date, because you are both going, both working.
You have to meet just on Zoom.
Yep. Now you have to meet on Zoom. But you guys both are working, doing art and using GPUs and deep learning and a bunch of other things. He does it all with a bunch of work in using human anatomy deep learning process, which is extraordinarily interesting. I think the two of you would really get along and have a great call. So after this, I'll remember. Cool. I'm going to set an email up so you guys can exchange some ideas and some stuff. He's also done a bunch of stuff that's been in exhibits as well. But your work has been in galleries and has seen many different forms of art and of the way you've done it. You've done some 3D printing, some images, some quote unquote holograms. What were some of the ways that you decided, here's how I'm going to represent all this work, right?
I guess that's also one thing I've been interested in exploring, is that, you know, what you got is generally this data in the computer, but representing it, materializing it, I guess, as the art speak goes, in different ways, you actually take very different things from it. I mean, so that's one thing I'm surprised by. It's not just a matter of, I've got the data, now I'm just trying to do something for, you know, put in a gallery. It's actually, you know, by seeing it in VR, by seeing it 3D printed, like seeing it at a printed or 2D, but at a level of resolution that you certainly can't do with 3D printing. All these different things bring you, you start noticing different details. I'm actually, I've just been working quite recently on using NVIDIA's optics library to, I mean, actually my own code has my own GPU ray tracing code in it.
Right.
Now, on a modern RTX card, NVIDIA's optics library is about 1,000 times faster. Okay. I was quite proud of my little GPU ray tracer for many years, but, it's like things have moved on. So I can now go from, basically it was taking, 10, 20 seconds to render a frame of my stuff before. 1,000 times faster, it's now interactive. And in particular, doing things that are interactive where you're doing like X-ray like views into the inside of the structure and things like that.
Right.
And, I'm now seeing things in data which I might have created, 5, 10 years ago, but by visualizing it differently, I'm seeing new things. I'm seeing new forms of the structures. So it's one thing I'm really actively interested in is, there's almost like, okay, let's 3D print it. And then you print it and then you see, start realizing there's things you weren't even aware of before in there.
Right.
So actually,
because you could see things from a different point of view.
Sort of 3D printed, like sort of vase like sort of structures.
Look at all that. That's amazing. Yeah. I'm glad we're doing video of this.
I'm going to show you if I can get to the side. There's my little 3D printer glowing at the background there. And
I can see it.
That sort of ball's actually also a 3D printed sort of structure.
Wow.
Actually, maybe I should bring that up to camera. Give a second.
Okay, sure. Wow.
Okay, I'm back. Probably got some horrible audio things there, but there you are.
That's okay.
3D printed.
The brain-like material.
Brain-like structure thing actually printed in 12 different pieces in my 3D printer.
Nice.
So there's also the challenge of almost like, now how do I get that data into a printable form? And then you print it and then you realize, sometimes you do, sometimes you don't, but sometimes you just think, wow, okay, now I see it. Oh, there's things there I didn't even realize.
That takes
a different direction. Or even just constraints. Actually, a lot of the vase structures, things that are up on those shelves. I mean, part of all of the thing behind that was how to modify the rules of the grow system to not force it so that everything's guaranteed to be 3D printable, but almost like bringing 3D printability as being something that could influence how it grows. So basically it was looking at overhang angles and things like that between cells as being one of the main things that limits you, whether it's 3D printable or not. And then using that to influence things like the rate of growth of the system. So different bits will be growing differently depending on how much they are in overhang. So the idea was I'm not trying to put like a hard engineering constraint in it, but I'm trying to allow the main thing that affects whether it's 3D printable to affect the structure. So hopefully there's
that's your physics rule.
It sort of almost means maybe that hopefully within the space of structures that could grow, there's a whole bunch of them which are naturally 3D printable, And it's a lot of things to play with. So it's almost like having to 3D print it forced me into thinking about, well, what allows it to be 3D printable? And then that then is end up going back into the system and hopefully ends up making some even more interesting structures and forms, So it's
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is really cool because I've been thinking about this for a while of your work. And then I saw your post, it was last week, I think, maybe the week before, that you posted a research paper you did on deep learning and aesthetic decision making, shall we say? Is that what did you call it?
Yeah, that works. Yeah.
Okay. And it's fascinating. And I could totally see, because obviously you're creating tons and tons and tons and tons of iterations of your stuff, right? Because it's constantly creating new things, right? Constantly creating new shells, new shapes, new ideas. And you realize that from a human point of view, you were mentioning before in nature, like there are certain things do you find more appealing or less appealing, right? You understand that. You helped, you're one of the co-authors in this paper about this. Can you, why don't you explain to people what this paper was about and how it came about? Because it's really fascinating.
Okay, I actually might go a little bit more of the backstory before.
Yeah, let's do that. Yeah.
The what's taken me down the road towards that, which I guess, yeah, so I was saying, Lee, you know, originally it was this run joke. Let's do all the things that, you know, you're not allowed to be paid to do professionally. And I've kind of, I've now sort of come more back a bit to the point of almost like a more interesting point is how to work creatively with these almost like rich out of control systems. You know, so I don't just want to press the button and just randomly does stuff. Right. I want to be involved influencing, actually steering is almost over control. It's almost like sort of a right level of control. So I want to be, you know, how do I actively explore what this can do and then sort of influence it to things that I'm particularly interested in, but without over controlling it, without over directing it. I don't want to, so I want to, it's almost what I want to do is I want to be able to make the system almost as out of control as possible, but still creatively influence it, creatively work with
it. You want
to
be a good parent, it sounds like.
Yeah. It's almost like I want the child to already be a teenager.
Yep.
As out of control as possible. They need to bring them back.
Sort
of.
Yeah.
So also just the number of parameters in the system. It's all of these things where, you know, too many controls, and you start giving the point where, I guess one of my big, you know, things is work often is saying that, you know, these sorts of systems often have places where the really interesting behavior happens. Is often like a transition place, a place where, you know, one behavior is turning into a different behavior, and where where the typical's happening, it's sort of interesting but not that interesting. And often the really you know, surprising stuff happens at these tipping points where one behavior turns into another behavior thing. So it's basically, it's how to explore, how to work with systems that are really out of control, but how to be able to still be a human in the loop, still be able to influence the system, still be able to work with it. So that's become a big part of my art side, is how do I stay in the loop rather than just set So I've been working on almost half of what I've been working on Software Rise for the last 10 years has actually been on that question, you know, how do I work with this. So one of the most recent things with that is I've been working with John McCormack, who if you haven't had on CG Garage, he's actually a really, really interesting guy.
Definitely put me in touch with him.
Artist, professor at Monash University, who runs a group called Sensi Lab down at Monash, which is about use of technology for creative use with all sorts of broad ideas within that. And he invited me to go down there last year, spend a few weeks at Monash. And sort of from that, it was something I was almost wanting to work in. This is the right opportunity to say, okay, well, one thing I've been wanting to do for a long time is, you know, current sort of deep neural nets, things that can, you know, be trained to recognize and categorize. And, you know, okay, a lot of it's saying it's Siamese cat versus tabby cat on a picture.
Right.
Driving a car and things. Can we use deep neural nets to help us as humans not take over, but actually help us navigate these spaces, find things more actively, help us explore? So that's basically what this research has been about, is I suppose core idea, I guess, is, you know, saying that the behavior, these systems typically have lots of different behaviors. And categorizing those behaviors is almost like a really useful way to then almost define what it means to look for the boundary. It's almost like, you know, first of all, it's almost like categorize the behaviors so that, you know, they can then say, well, when you're moving from one behavior to another one, or when you're finding something which your system that's got very used to categorizing behaviors can't categorize it, it's surprised, it doesn't know what this is. So it's almost like categorizing is a quite human thing to do, but can we be assisted to make that process even almost playful? It's almost what I want to do is give it as few examples as possible. Just say, this thing I think looks, you know, I could say that thing, you know, Chris, we've agreed that looks a bit like a brain. Maybe I've got another thing that looks a bit like broccoli. Then another thing that looks we sort of categorize these. Could I just give it as few examples as possible and then let it go off and hopefully find the crazy hybrid, the thing where, you know, it's sort of, it's almost deliberately finding the points in the space where one behavior is turning into a different behavior.
Right.
That hopefully is, hopefully makes sense. That's the core of, you know, what we're doing. So it's almost like make that process of categorizing as easy as possible, because I don't want to hand categorize 10,000 things. And then use that data to find those transition places.
So this is an interesting thing. If you think about what deep learning is, obviously it goes through and it processes tens of thousands of things, right? And what you're trying to do is saying, I want to process a few things and have it process the rest of the things for me based on what it learned, as little as possible, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I hope you get to the point where it can divide the space up into meaningful categories.
Right. What did you describe it as in the video? I saw it, like user fatigue or something. What was it?
Mm-hmm. That's actually not my name. That's actually there's a technique that's been used for many years, is what's called interactive genetic algorithms, IGAs.
Right.
Using, you know, ideas of mutation and crossbreeding and things like that. This became really trendy in the 90s.
Okay.
So, you know, that's some really cool computer art from back then that, you know, used interactive genetic algorithms. Basically using, you know, genetic algorithm techniques of, you know, I've got data and with rules for how I go from a genotype to a phenotype, but as computer data. But then using things a bit like our evolution ideas, the idea of, you know, I can mutate and crossbreed things together. And then the things which are somehow scored as being the fittest are the ones that survived and produce the offspring for the next generation. And the idea of doing it for an art things, where I'm just looking at things saying, I like that, don't like that. And the ones that I've said I like are the ones that get the parents for the next generation.
Right.
So it's a very, really fascinating idea. It's like stealing from nature, but to do art things. And people have, you know, exhibitions in galleries where, you know, you know, depending on how long people spent in front of which video screen, would we be using to determine which ones people most liked, and the ones that most people most liked would then get the ones that would get most bread and things like that.
Right.
But one problem that people have identified with these sort of systems is that it becomes very tiring. You can do it often, you know, 10 minutes, half an hour, and then you just get really bored.
Yes.
Like, you know, and especially if you can't really see where it's going. I take all these things, and then it's like...
I know. From my old days in Lightroom, trying to process like 100,000 pictures and trying to figure out how to tag them all. Ugh, that's tedious and horrible.
Tedious and horrible. User fatigue. Yeah. Posh research speech for tedious and horrible.
Right, yeah. So basically you're trying to figure out like how to train the system by giving it as few inputs as possible and have the deep learning process do the rest of the categorization for you based on its best guess. Is that how it works, basically?
That's sort of the first half of it. Yeah, the idea is that, I mean, I put stuff into my software that's called Species Explorer ages ago to have the idea of categories, and then you know, potentially I could then use those categories to do things like, you know, define fitness as being probability of being brain-like multiplied by probability being broccoli-like, and an area in space which is as a high value of that multiplied by that is potentially a hybrid and things like that. So I've already got things in there to be the idea of, you know, let's use categories to actively try to find places where hybrid. The reality of it, though, was the user fatigue. The, you know, you'd often only after generating, you know, a few thousand of these things start to sort of see the categories.
Right.
And, you know, it's just then really tedious going through 1,000 things going, that's a broccoli, that's a broccoli, that's a broccoli, that's a broccoli.
Yeah.
And also, potentially even more, is that you want to be playful with it. You want to maybe put things into categories really quickly so that you can then go, actually, maybe let's change it. Let's do the categories differently. Let's do this, you know. Whereas if you've spent, you know, ages categorizing 1,000 things, the last thing you would then want to do is just to then go, actually, maybe if I change it, maybe if I take that category and divide it into another three categories, or maybe combine those two together. And you want to be able to playfully you want to make the process of making categories as easy as possible and as quick as possible, both to put things in categories and modify and change them around. And then hopefully what you've then got is really useful basically just data that the computer can use for things a bit like evolutionary genetic algorithms, or actually even with evolutionary genetic algorithms, but you can also use other potential machine learning things, can almost then use that data so that you can then sort of set it off a bit like a sort of like, you know, sniffer dog to go, you go, computer, now you go and try and find the thing that you can't categorize, or try and find the thing that, you know, really does appear to be at a point of transition between the different categories. So in some ways, I think that's the even more interesting thing is the, you know, how to find those transitions, but you also then need the right data.
So yeah, that would be kind of almost identifying the mutations in a lot of ways, right?
Actually, particularly finding the things where the computer gets confused, I guess. I mean, a lot of these machine learning systems, you know, they go, you know, that's a Siamese cat. Mm-hmm. As you dig one or two layers deeper, up in the neurons,
right,
before that final layer where it's gone, Siamese cat.
Right.
Often these things have probability measures where actually what it's got is it's saying it's 92% thinks it's Siamese cat.
Right.
5% thinks it's tabby. 7% thinks it's a fern, you know, whatever.
Right.
So it's often they've got these probabilities. And so you can get the idea of confusion, the idea of, you know, where is it confused?
Mm.
And actually, is that something that's interesting? So it's almost like it's all sort of different. So this is ongoing research. That's one area that we're interested in. It's almost like saying, after you've trained it, if I'm interested in novelty, you know, I'm not interested in it. It just categorizing is almost like, the tool. What I'm really interested in is, new things.
Right.
Surprise me. So
now,
surprising me might be almost sort of the equivalent of surprise me in machine learning terms, maybe saying it's got a high confusion level.
Right.
That's when it doesn't understand what it's looking at. Okay, now show that to me. I'm interested in seeing what the computer can't make sense of.
But because you're creating these systems that are unpredictable, right? Mm-hmm. And that by design.
Yeah.
But at the same time, in order to generate data, there's a parameters that you must be entering, obviously, into these systems to generate whatever they're happening. Mm-hmm. So is the deep learning algorithm correlating the parameters with the decision-making category or whatever is going on as well? So it's like, if I move this parameter, I'm more likely to get this category or this whatever. Is that something that it does?
That's sort of next steps. I mean, what we're already doing is we're using the machine learning to potentially score was like fitness score, whether it, right. Actually what we've got is categories, and also thing in this paper was it also I'd looked at everything and saying, you know, just subjectively, oh, that's rubbish, I'll get that a 2, I'll get that a 0, I'll get that a 0,
right,
that's a 4, whoa, right, that's an 8, that's a 9,
right,
you know, that's a 10, oh, I've run out of category numbers, that's an 11, I want 11. so I'd, you know, I was giving everything just subjective numbers where, right, you know, this and it is very subjective, just me looking at going, those two almost look the same, but that's a 5 and that's a 7.
Right.
I just think they are. You know, I might come back tomorrow and think otherwise. So I guess we were getting the computer to actually surprisingly accurately, I think, agree with my ratings as well.
Interesting.
So what we can do is we can use that to almost like choose new parameters. So it's almost like you could try, almost like the computer randomly chooses, you know, 100,000 parameters, but we've got some way of maybe having an estimate, a prediction. To start with, it's probably going to be an awful prediction, but as it goes on, it's hoping to get better and better prediction of that new point, that new set of parameters. What prediction is it that I'm going to like it or not?
Right.
You know,
and does it categorize you as a person and your taste versus someone else's as a person and their taste?
Well, the data it's using is all just things I've rated and categorized.
Sure, but you could say
give someone else as well.
Give Chris his hit the, as many, you know, 7 or above things that he likes, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you would go and look for different things. I mean, to some of I often find things which I think some other people find really quite disgusting. I like to look at it and sort of think of, you know, this is completely pure computer data. It's often, I'm often running things, it's just, they're just white balls rendered with ambient occlusion generally.
Right. Yep.
You know, pure computer data, but people look at it and go, well, that's really disturbing.
Right.
I think that's quite interesting.
It is strange that you're looking basically at a math equation represented visually and you have a feeling of disgust. It's a completely emotional response to a mathematical equation.
I think gets to a point where, you know, yeah. And then the human in the loop, the thing that feels that reaction.
Right.
Some other people might not really not like things that I look at and go, well, I'm going to give that a 9 because I'm really interested in it. I think it looks quite...
Right.
It's just, I mean, it surprised me, and I'm, yeah, okay. So I'm almost maybe steering it towards those points in space. So basically what we're doing is we're using these... I've actually got a number of different techniques that can be used to generate the next set of parameters. And machine learning can feed into that in a number of ways. So one thing that we haven't done yet, but we're planning to do is, depending on the machine learning algorithm you're using, some of them you can get meaningful gradients in the space. Now, how meaningful they are can depend. That's a genuine research we've still got to do. But there are ideas of we could do what's called gradient descent methods and things like that in these spaces and see what work on gradients where, or you could just say, I deliberately want to, from this point of space, move as fast as possible towards maximizing the probability of being in a different category and things like that. There are things where by being in a machine learning framework, you can start doing things like that. So yeah, this is very much ongoing work, but that's, you know, whereas without that, you tend to just be randomly sampling points and looking at them. Yeah, the point where you can just say, I've not only got a prediction of what the category will be at this point in space, but I've also got a prediction of, you know, what the likelihood of being in a different category is as you move in different directions.
Right. Now, this research is amazing, and I love the idea of it, and I love the what it's doing. I also have this amazing feeling that I love it because I don't necessarily see right now a direct correlation to something practical that it can do. because I think that's
crazy things.
Yes, well, I think that's great because then in a lot of ways it's freeing you of being able to do needing to make it practical, right?
Yeah.
And that allows you to just keep going and going and going. Do you feel like maybe there is a practical thing and maybe I should like somehow turn this into something practical, or do you like the fact that you can just do whatever you want with it in a sense?
I like playing. I was for a few years I was a tutor at the Bartlett, which is basically UCL University College London's architecture school, which is this,
very good school.
Very, very theoretical. I mean, it has got
a
bit of a reputation of, you know, once every few years, somebody comes up with something that looks like a building.
Right.
A lot of their stuff is, I think, actually beautifully abstract and things like that. Mm-hmm. But they're within architecture engineering, I mean, the idea of, you know, generative systems feeding into things and into, and also biology ideas feeding into engineering, bio-inspired, biomimetic, you know, I think there is potential of quite a lot of that, this stuff in that sort of space. You know, actually in some ways, particularly it's the, you know, I think there's a thing of really interesting rich systems, almost engineering, like I guess, large, maybe just oversimplifying things a lot. But a lot of engineering is about finding a lot of very, very simple components that you completely understand, and then you assemble things out of those, you know, the same components every, you know, that you have completely understood what they do. Biology works in completely different ways. It's almost more like these systems of, you know, where you can mix together, you know, all sorts of different you know, amounts of what's called chitination, how much, you know, hardness is put into something that can make everything from skin to nails to bone to cartilage to, by mixing and matching different things and having these, you know, complex rules for then how you then build, assemble this material that can have all sorts of different material properties and the structures and things that you're creating. You've almost got a palette that you can make a really complex, interesting behavior, but it's really difficult to understand. It's really difficult to direct it. So I do think there is a practical thing of some of these ideas potentially get into, well, with those sorts of systems, maybe what you don't want to do is dumb the system down too much. You want the system still to be rich, almost there, totally out of control.
Right.
But to be able to steer it. So it's almost like a how to work with complex, rich ingredient systems, which are much more like the sorts of things that nature uses than what we as humans usually use, because we sort of tend to control things. You want predictable behavior,
right?
But predictable behavior maybe has lost a lot of the potentialities.
So you bring up an interesting point, because there's now in the world of architecture, and you know that came, a lot of it came from schools like Bartlett and stuff like that, where people really got interested in parametric systems for design, right? So yeah. Grasshopper, I'm sure you're familiar with Grasshopper as a system. And now a lot of people are using Grasshopper for their design process in architecture. It's very popular, right? Mm-hmm. The problem is everything looks like it was designed in Grasshopper now, because they all seem to be using the same parameters because they're not exploring the software enough. And all these facades that I'm seeing is like, that looks like it was designed in Grasshopper, and it looks very similar to other things. So I'm almost thinking about the way that, you know, your software works, where you can say, hey, instead of just using that, how about finding a new category, something unique, something that's expressive, or something in another way that seems like there, if you're going to give this power of generative design to people, especially in the architecture world, how do you make it so it has a unique flavor, and it's not basically just looks like the same thing? Mm-hmm. Because it seems ridiculous that something that is parametric looks like everything else that's parametric.
Yeah, I think there's always this, by being parametric, you know, the system itself will probably have some natural sorts of things that it tends to do, or
right.
You know, there are limits of what you can do with those parameters and things. So yeah, actually one of the running jokes when I was at the Bartlett was whenever a student would show something that had been created parametrically and go, and right. So this is the optimal solution. And I'm going, no, it isn't, you know,
right.
It's sort of like, that's a good solution in that, from that particular system, but
right.
In any way calling that optimal, it's almost like, because you've passed this through a box that says optimizer on it, doesn't mean
right.
That you have come up with the optimal solution. You know,
yes, thank you.
So there's students rapidly relearn the don't use the
and architecture
when I was around.
I went to Rice Architecture School, so I was an architect as well, and they had very similar things. And this is back in the 90s when chaos was very popular, and then architects were basically just borrowing from math and thing terms that they had no idea what they were talking about. Like I was just, it just, as a math person, I just used to bang my head against the wall when they were saying, this is based on imaginary numbers. I'm like, do you even know what that means? It's like, how does the square root of -1 have anything to do with what you just showed me? And they're like, what do you mean? It's like, imaginary numbers just, I think you just like the term imaginary. That doesn't make it imaginary numbers.
I actually think the word imaginary was one of the worst namings of any concept in mathematics. It's just like a way of doing maths in a 2D plane. That's
right.
You know, that's it. You know, it's two-dimensional mathematics. I mean, if you call it that, it sounds boring, doesn't it? 2D maths. I think there's, as you know, there's the philosophy of parametricism. The running joke was that the group I was in, we started calling everything just attributes, or
right.
It was like, you know, just saying, because you've got something that has attributes doesn't mean that you are necessarily subscribing to the whole philosophy of parametricism. Just because you've got a system that's parametrically run on parameters isn't the same as parametricism as almost like a
and very popular in the 90s also was talking about architecture as being topological. I'm like, You mean the study of maps? Because that's what topological means, or study of mapping. But it's like, because they do just see the basically the picture on the cover of the book of a topology book, and they would see a Klein bottle or some kind of a, you know, other object, mm-hmm. mostly Klein bottles or knots, the trefoil knots. And they're like, topological. It's like, well, it's a pretty picture on the book of the cover of the math book, but it's not what topology means.
So I'm a great believer. I get more like, you know, Turing-like sort of thing. I mean, the ability of a computer to potentially generate everything, almost like anything that is computable, you have enough memory, you could compute. It's almost like the astonishing blank canvas. I mean, all the Church-Turing hypothesis that, you know, anything that we can compute is probably the same as what any, even the simplest computer could compute, as long as it had enough memory. So the range of possibilities is incredible. I think people are often very limited by current tools, or using, copying what has already been done, slightly changing. I think there's, things like Grasshopper as being the tool that potentially could do anything, but then there are the dangers of becoming too much just within the style. I mean, like people at Bartlett, they look at everything, it's like, it's the Voronoi plugin for Grasshopper again.
Yes.
Stop it.
Yep.
There's the overuse of the current flavor.
Yeah.
Again, but what this system is potentially capable of is so enormous. Mm-hmm. It's almost frightening, which is where I think that, ideas of saying, how does, almost like nature's the existence proof of you can work with astonishingly complex systems and come up with amazingly surprising results. I'm not saying that nature does everything in a perfect way at all. I absolutely think the opposite, actually. I think that, nature is, almost like a great categorization of nature, is making astonishingly good use of amazingly bad design again and again. It's just like, you've done what? With what?
Yep.
Why? Your optic nerve comes out from the front, through the front of your retina?
Right.
Really? That's just
right where you should be.
Easily stupid.
You should have more rods there, and instead you have a big black hole.
Exactly, because your wiring comes out through the wrong direction. Really bad original design, and you couldn't fix it.
Yeah.
But it does show, it shows, at least it shows up a glimmer of the possibilities.
Right. Yeah, I think it's wonderful. I think, when I see your work and I hear you talk about it, it just brings me back to me thinking about, honestly speaking, when I was a math major in college and I would take classes like abstract algebra or topology, etc., I would go back to my room and I would, I couldn't shut off my brain. It was so wonderful to sit there and imagine all these things. It was just hard to understand. I remember when I was first trying to understand, I was very young and I was like, how do you represent four-dimensional space in three dimensions? And it was, then you start to realize like, oh, well, I'm just taking a camera that does 3D and takes it to 2D, and I just apply it one more dimension. And then just thinking about that was really freeing. And it was just like, when I talk to you and I hear all the stuff you're doing, and I love how you're like trying to basically design a system that's completely out of control, and loving it.
Unruly. I like the
unruly
idea. Yeah. It's almost like having the unruly companion.
Right.
You don't want to over-tame, but you need to semi-tame.
Yes. Yeah. That's really, really cool. I think it's really great. And I really definitely think that you should check out some of Scott's work, because it's really incredible. And I'll send you some links of some of his talks about behavior, because I think you guys would get along. And at some point when, lockdown subsides, at some point you guys should definitely get together and exchange some ideas. But listen, we've gone over an hour, and it's been a fascinating conversation. This is the kind of stuff that gets me excited. And I love your work. I love the paper you wrote as well. And I'm going to put a link to people to follow that as well. Is there a written form of it as well that people can check out?
Yeah, okay. I'll send you the email. Yeah, John's put it up on ArcViz. So it's a freely accessible online version of the paper.
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you so
Hopefully
much.
Hopefully it's almost in English. No, it's in a combination between Brit English and Aussie English, because
Aussie,
okay. Australian.
Two different Englishes. Yes, that's true. All right. Well, thank you so much, Andy. I appreciate it.
Okay. It's a pleasure.